Okay, so let's begin. My name is Donald D. Gasper. I'll be the interviewer, and the interviewee is John Percy. John, your middle initial, please?
It's B as in Baker.
B as in Baker.
Yeah, okay. John B. Percy.
John B. Percy. And today is the 6th of October, a Saturday, 2001, and we're at Mr. Percy's residence in Bloomington, Illinois. And this is tape one, side A. And the project of this, or the purpose of this oral history project, is to interview veterans of the air war over Europe during World War II. And in this interview, this oral history interview is being conducted under the auspices of a graduate level course at Southern Illinois University at Edwardsville. The course is specifically Approaches to Oral History, History 447. So I, at this point, would like to ask Mr. Percy to say and spell his full name, just to make sure we get that straight.
Okay, it's John, and middle initial is B, as in Baker. Last name is Percy, and that's P-E-R-C-Y.
Your middle name, I'm sorry.
Middle name is Burke. B-U-R-K-E, Burke.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. So let's go ahead and stop the tape at this point and just do a sound check and make sure we're in good shape.
If you want to, I could have said John Burke Percy if you want to do it that way.
That'll work out. I'm fine. All right. Well, we conducted our sound check and both parties are sounding pretty well loud and clear. So let's begin with our questions for Mr. Percy and his role in the air war during World War II over Europe. So, Sir John, if you would, let's begin with if you could mention your place of birth and date, and then tell me something about your childhood growing up here in the local area. Of course, I understand having conducted a summer internship at the Prairie Aviation Museum, and we've spoken in the past particularly about your role in helping to keep that museum's DC-3 flying, that I know you were practically born on a runway, and your military service, 20 years as a corporate pilot for State Farm Insurance here in Bloomington, and in fact, even today, at the age of, I'm sorry, what is it?
77,
you still fly your own private aircraft, so quite a lifetime of aviation experience. But, of course, I'll try and be quiet and let you tell us about, again, your, if you would, your place of birth, date of birth, your childhood growing up here in the local area, if you would.
Sure. Well, I was born in Bloomington. In fact, I was born at the farmhouse. And I was born February 15, 1942. And, of course, lived on the farm growing up, going to high school. And our farm happens to be about 1,500 yards from the airport. Now, the airport was built in 1934. I didn't start going down to the airport until I was, I guess, 1939. I was about 14 or 15 years of age. And I'd sneak off and go down there, gas airplanes, wash airplanes, maybe so I could get a ride with a guy on Sunday. And by when I turned 18, you're a graduate from high school in 42, parent says, yes, if you want to fly, go ahead. And I went to the manager, and he knew that I'd been getting some lessons on the side, but I said, I want to learn to fly, but I don't have any money. And he said, we have three runways, grass runways. If you'll mow the runways, I'll give you flying time. So that's what I did that summer. I mowed all the runways at the airport, and I was able to solo and with 8 hours in a T-craft. And then...
Explain for someone who may not be familiar with it. Well, a training craft. What
it
type
was a Taylor craft. It's a two-seater. I think it had 50 horsepower in it. And it just called a Taylor craft. And we call them a T craft. just two place. And anyway, after I soloed, at the time, the Air Force or the Aviation Cadet, the Army Air Corps requirements were you had to have 2 years of college. I think in November of that year, they waived the 2 years of college and they set up the Aviation Cadet Program. And they had a station at Peoria. You could go over there and take the state nine test, the physicals, and all that. So I went over on a bus and did that, and by 5 o'clock that night, well, you raised your right hand, says I do, so that's when I joined the Aviation Cadet Program. I think it was the 14th of December of 1942. And they said, go home and we'll give you a call. And then I was called up active duty on the, I think it was the 17th of February. So I had just
43.
43, so I had just turned 19. And went into the Aviation Cadet Program. And from there, of course, we went out to basic training, Wichita Falls, Texas. And from basic training, we went to pre-flight, which was at Maxwell Air Force Base, and that's where you learned, like you were a cadet going through...
I'm sorry, John, that basic training took how long, roughly?
Oh, basic training? Probably 6 weeks or so, I suppose.
And then you went on to...
What to call
pre-flight, which was roughly how long?
About the same, I guess. There it was all physical fitness, road running. You learn to have your square meals like you do at West Point. You got all your military training.
Square meals, for someone who may not be familiar with that, that's where, what, you pick up your utensil and make a 90-degree angle.
90-degree turn, right. And use one hand at a time.
Right.
Of course, I got the problem because I'm left-handed. But anyway, it was, that, and also that's where, you know, that was mainly a physical fitness training setup. Okay.
Well, okay, basic training in a nutshell, learning.
Basic training was also road runs, carrying a pack, how to shoot a rifle. And then too, they put you on a bivouac and they have your gas attacks, you know, with tear gas. And march, you know, learn the rules.
And when you say pre-flight training, of course, there was more of the physical conditioning.
Yeah.
And to what extent was there the aviation angle brought into that training?
Not much at the time.
So pre-flight, but not much to do with flight whatsoever?
No, no. They just call it pre-flight. And then you were supposed to go to classification, but they had such a backlog of people that they set up this, what they call a college training detachment. CTDs, and all the different units around went to the different colleges. I ended up at Murfreesboro, Tennessee at the State Teachers College. We had to be there for 30 days. And due to the backlog, we ended up 6 months. And you went back just like you're going back to college, geometry and all the different history and all the different courses. Now there, besides drilling and physical fitness, we did get 10 hours of dual in an Aeronica aircraft. That's a two-place aircraft trainer.
10 hours of dual instruction.
Of dual, and no solo.
Right.
And then that was to determine more or less when you went to classification whether the instructor said you'd be a good pilot or a bad pilot or didn't think he'd make the grade on your flying ability. Now, we'd heard through the grapevine that if you had previous flying time, they'd send you to glider school. So I said, no, I don't want to be a glider pilot. I want to be a fighter pilot.
When you say previous flight time, just to back up a second, how many hours would you say you had in flight time, whether solo or with an instructor, prior to your entry in the Aviation Cadet Program?
12 hours.
12 hours?
Yeah.
Flying here at the...
At Bloomington Airport,
Bloomington.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, is now known as the Central Illinois Regional Airport. And back in the 30s?
34 was when the airport was built.
And what was it known as?
Just the Bloomington Normal Airport.
Okay. All right. And I'm just curious, going back to your childhood, of course, what, you saw aircraft, well, after 34,
yeah.
flying around your home quite a bit, and as you said, you started mowing the grass to get some flight time.
Well, for instance, back in 40 and 41, this instructor, his name was Archie Baldridge, he ended up my instructor, they would go out to the county fairs during the summer, like out of Manier and the different fairs, and they'd call up and they'd mow a pasture, say, an alfalfa field. And it happened that our phone line was on the same party line, about 7 at the time, and he'd go around, he'd talk to my mom and said, what's John doing, and can he go with me? And so what he would do was we'd take out the dual controls, and take a 5-gallon gas can, I'd straddle it in the airplane, and we'd fly out to the county fair. And then it was a dollar ride. I'd sell the tickets and prop the airplane.
When you say prop the airplane?
Well, start the engines. Yeah, start the engine for him. Because it would shut down every time, so he didn't want people walking into the propeller.
Yeah.
And anyway, then during the evening, just before dark, why, we always seemed to burn enough gas. We'd put the 5 gallons into the gas tank. We'd put that in the baggage compartment. He'd put the dual controls in, take off, says, okay, now take me home. So I cheated a little bit, got a little extra flying time really before I started taking my first dual lesson. But that's how I got interested in it. And then I, like to say, I gassed airplanes so I could get a ride on Sunday with one of the guys there. One of the lawyers was Louis Probasco. He had a beautiful two-place airplane.
What type, I'm sorry?
Oh, can't think of the name right now. It was built down in St. Louis. They used it in racing aircraft back in 32 and 33. Not an air coupe, but Airmaster was built by Cessna. I can't think of the name right now.
Well, and then, of course, with your growing interest in aviation, and other than that, well, yeah. You grew up in the farming
yeah.
role was, of course, the day-to-day until
oh, well,
you,
sure.
as, and then aviation became more and more your passion.
Right.
And that. And you come from a family that's lived here for...
Yes, the farm right now is where the Central Illinois Airport is, where the new terminal is being built. That farmland, my grandfather, it belongs to our family, was in the family since 1872. And we happened to have be one of the first families in McLean County that received the centennial or 100-year plaque. That was my mom's heyday.
Yes, your family, quite a fixture in the local area for
yeah.
some time. So, well, again, getting back to the evolution of your
yeah.
training, and you were discussing the college training
yeah.
detachment, and then your 10 hours of dual instruction at that point. So let's see, you mentioned basic training of
yeah.
around 6 weeks, pre-flight training of around six
yeah.
weeks, the college training detachment, which because of the backlog ended up being about a
six-month yeah.
stint. And then after that,
then we went to, since it was Murfreesboro, Tennessee, we went to Nashville, Tennessee for classification. And there...
Well, when you say classification,
okay.
that's to get a specific...
Okay, you took all the State 9 tests and...
I'm sorry, what tests?
What they call State 9 tests, you know, physiological tests and physicals and all that. And from the tests that you took, they determined whether you were going to be a pilot, a bombardier, or navigator. That's why they call it classification. And that's where you got your assignments, is to which route you were going to go in the aviation cadet program. I lucked out. I was assigned as a pilot.
Well, I'm sure your background up to that
well,
point
I don't know if it did or not.
Might have helped.
Try to get the square pegs and round holes, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, and then the aviation cadet program, which I believe you said you started in December of 42.
Well, that's when I joined.
Or so joined the program.
Yeah, that's when my date starts as far as my retirement goes.
So then once you were determined to go to be a pilot,
yeah.
then you started that training.
Yeah, then I went to primary.
Primary.
And that was at Jackson, Tennessee. And there we, our group had the PT-19, which was built by Fairchild, open cockpit. In fact, it had 175 horsepower, Ranger engine, it was inverted six-cylinder job. Real nice airplane. And I think we got, what, 40 hours? Maybe, I suppose, 60, maybe 60s, between 60 and 70 hours in primary. And then after primary, went to basic training. That was the VT-13. We call it the vibrating Volte vibrator. Anyway, that was at Newport, Arkansas. And there's where they taught you instrument training, which was the biggest thing on it. You got over 25 hours of instrument training. They taught you formation plan. We used to make formation takeoff and formation landing, generally on grass fields, you know, auxiliary fields. And plus nighttime, night flying. And of course, too, they had radios for your navigation purposes on that. Then after that, you went to advanced training, and I went to Moultrie, Georgia, which is at Spence Field. And from basic, you either went to twin engine school or you went to single engine. Spence Field was single engine AT-6s.
Just to try and get an idea of the passage of time, your primary flight training took you roughly how long?
I suppose we were there, what, 3 months?
Okay.
Originally, if you started on flight training, it took just about a year to go through the training of the time you started and time you graduated. But due to the 6 month backlog and all that, I didn't graduate until June of 1944. Started out in what they call class of 44A, but due to the CTT training 6 months later, that's why I started. Actually, we started flying, I think, in December of 43, and then we graduated in June of 44. So it's 7 months, 7 month course. You're about 6 weeks in each phase, roughly.
So
trying to think back.
Okay, so the primary took about 6 weeks.
I would say,
Basic took about 6 weeks, and then the advanced.
Yeah, same thing.
Took about 6 weeks. So the passage of time from December of 43 to when you won your wings in June of 44.
June of 44,
All right.
And of course, T-6 training, of course, since that time you were flying single engine and hoping that you'd get to be a fighter pilot, even though when you got your wings, when you graduated, you didn't know for sure what type of aircraft you're going into. A couple of friends of mine, they ended up B-24s, B-17s. So you really never knew until the day after you got your wings, and the following week is when you got your assignments.
Just curious, before you go get to your assignment, what kind of washout rate did you notice in the primary, basic, advanced? If there tended to be more washouts at certain points or whatever?
Basic training, I suppose maybe 20-30% maybe. And then in advance, since they had so many people in advance too, we 300 of us went in and 200 graduated. So that's about a third washout. Now out of that 200 that graduated, there was 95 that were made as flight officers, and the other 105 were second lieutenants. The reason the flight officer rank was designed is there were too many second lieutenant commissioned officers in the Manning document, according to the, in Pentagon. So they had to devise a new rank, so they came out with what they call the flight officer rank. Now it had a bar, looked like a racetrack, and it had two little blue things that we call it the purple pickle. But you had the same privileges as any of the pilots. It's just that you ended up as a non-commissioned officer because of the Manning document. The only thing that did if you went overseas as a commissioned officer, you got 10% of your base pay being in combat. A non-commissioned officer gets 20%. So I go overseas with the same buddy I graduated with. He's a second lieutenant, I'm a flight. I get 20% of my base pay.
A little silver lining to going into harm's way. Huh?
Right. But that was how that rank developed and everything.
So then you got assigned, we can say within a week or so, and you found out.
Well, actually, we graduated on a Saturday. Monday morning, we were on a bus, and I went to Tifton, Georgia, to fly the P-40, the P-40 Warhawk, the ones they used in General Chenault's China.
Made by Curtis.
Yeah, Curtis, yeah. Ours had either Allison and Rolls-Royce engines. They had different ones.
And I'm sorry, you were flying at Tifton, did you say?
Tifton, Georgia. T-I-F-T-O-N. Yeah. Just up the road a piece from where they come over.
And so that was considered as an assignment?
As a fighter pilot.
As a fighter pilot. Assigned to a unit, a training unit.
Well, just training unit. Yeah. You only got 10 hours in the airplane.
Ah, yes, it's just turned 11 a.m. Yeah. I should say we started this interview, roughly 10:40 a.m., somewhere in that neck of the woods. But anyways, to carry on, so you started training in a fighter-type aircraft, the P-40, and that...
Of course, with it, you have to realize there's no instructors. Even though you said you had an instructor, what you did, we went to ground school for a week to learn all the systems in the aircraft. Then they let you get in the aircraft and go through all the switches, and they gave you a blindfold cockpit check. Instructor would make sure you knew where all the switches were. Then they let you start the engine and taxi the airplane out, and he was standing on the wing. At the end of the runway, you made your run-up, mag check and all that, check system, everything was gone to go. He patted you on the shoulder and says, have a good flight, and steps off the airplane. So you're in this aircraft by yourself. And to me, that aircraft, I still remember it. I had the biggest thrill flying that aircraft, I think, as I did when I sold the T-Craft the first time. I mean, that was a tiger by the tail, because it had narrow gear and it had over 1,000 horsepower, and it was really something. And then after you went up for about an hour and come back and shot 3 or 4 landings, and the next day they'd send an instructor with you, another aircraft, to teach flyman formation. And did a little dogfighting and stuff like that. But we got a lot of dogfighting and all the maneuvers in advance, at Spence Field when you're going through advanced training. You got all that.
So you spent your training phase in the P-40 for roughly how long?
Oh, we were only there about 2 or 3 weeks, I guess, total. We only got 10 hours of flying time.
Okay, and then you went off to...
Then I was assigned to Richmond, Virginia, to go in to fly the P-47, a Thunderbolt.
Which of what became the actual aircraft you flew in combat?
Yeah, combat, yeah. Nicknamed the Jug.
yeah. Very large radial engine aircraft for its time. Well, with a large fuselage, large 850 caliber, very...
See, it was the heaviest single engine fighter ever built. It weighed between 18 to 20,000 pounds. Now, you're talking 9 and 10 tons on one engine. And they had a good engine, the Pratt & Whitney R2800, produced a little over 2,000 horsepower. Super airplane. Good survivability airplane. It got me there and got me back.
Amen. So, and then your actual training time in the P-47, or how long was, were you stateside doing that prior to shipping out?
Let's see. Well, we started flying, I guess it was in August, and 44. And then, I can't remember how many hours we got out, 78 hours in the airplane. Then we went to gunnery, and I went to gunnery at Norfolk, Virginia. And there's where they taught us for dive bomb and strafing, shooting its sleeve. We had the old Murata B-26 towed the target for you. But we only got to use the .250 calibers. We never shot all 8 calibers going through gunnery school. We only used the 2 guns. And out on the island off of Maryland there is where they had stationary targets, unilateral and strafe. And they had buildings that looked outhouses out there to try to drop your bombs on it. We used 25-pound bombs. And we're learning how to do that. And we did shoot gunnery. See, a 47 was built for a high altitude aircraft. Now, we used to shoot gunnery as high as around 15,000 feet, towing targets. And then we did what they call the camera gunnery at 32,000 feet, with just another jug flying it, and he'd make passes at him with the camera. And they did it with your pictures on that. And then finished that training, and that ended up in January, and then, I think I got finally a two or three week leave to come home, and then we shipped to, I guess Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and we got on a boat in New York and then went overseas, and I got overseas in end of February, 1st of March.
March of 45.
Yeah, 45. I went over by ship. We were on board ship 13 days, I think, by boat.
And at that point, the U-boat threat had pretty well receded.
Well, somewhat, yeah. Our particular boat, we were in a convoy of 15 ships, and it turned out that the aircraft carrier in front of us during the night lost the steering, and the ship was just directly in front of us. He hit the bow of his ship, and he lost about 20 people, put a hole in it. They ended up limping to Azores, and then when we went in, our ship went into Le Havre at night, across the English Channel, and they let all the army troops off the boat. And then that night, then we went back across the English Channel to England.
Okay.
We landed at Southampton, England.
And your first base then?
Somewhere in Britain, I don't remember the name of it. We were there for 2 weeks as a matter of getting assignments, make sure all your shots were up to date, and checking your physical condition again before you got your assignment to your outfit.
And so then you proceeded?
Then I went to the outfit, yeah. I was assigned to the 324th Fighter Group. Of course, there's 3 squadrons in a group. It was 14th, 15th, 16th. I ended up in the 315th squadron.
And you primarily were based out of?
Oh, we were based in Lunéville, France. Don't ask me how to spell Lunéville. It's outside of Nancy, France, about 30 miles, southern sector. My outfit originally started out in Tunisia, Sicily, Naples, Rome, came up through the southern sector, and after Lunéville, when the war ended, we ended up in Stuttgart, Germany.
But as far as your combat
time
was all,
it was
out,
all
of
out of Lunéville, out of France, yeah. And all my missions were all over Germany.
But all of them you took off from Lunéville?
Yeah.
Did you didn't have any other combat flights from other airfields?
No.
Okay.
See, another thing, since we were fighter bombers, we did dive bomber strafing. We were supporting the 10th and 12th Armored Tank Divisions. So to help support those, they took pilots from each squadron, we were sent up to the front lines as a forward air controller. So I spent the last 30 days as a forward air controller with the 10th Armored Tank Division.
That was how many days?
Last month of World War II, from April to May.
So, right, with what, May 8th, the surrender?
Yeah, we happened to end up at Garmisch, parking in Garmisch.
Yes.
With the 10th Armored Tank Division.
So you got to see how the Army operated up close and personal, shall we say.
Yes.
And So then your combat flight time ran from roughly
March
of 45 till
about the middle of April, yeah. Actually, I guess I got about 250 hours in the P-47, and the flight log shows I flew 75 hours of combat time. But for instance, I had a little history here of our group.
Oh, you jotted down some notes.
Yeah. Okay, on the notes I got down for, we were, our 350 squad was called the Crusaders. Anyway, the particular group now, which is all three squadrons, the history, they were activated in November of 41, and they were deactivated in November of 45, this particular group. So by them starting out in Sicily, they actually started out in P-40s. And I think when they were on the island of Corsica, they turned to the P-47, the Thunderbolt. They switched over to the Jug and then flew the P-47s the rest of the
Well, group. One thing I'm wondering about with your notes is, while those are, describe the unit history, are there notations there that apply to your personal experiences? In other words, a historian might be able to refer to some other sources.
They can pick all that up. For instance here, 19th of March, 45, the 324th, we flew 234 sorties in one day, setting a record for one day's flying over combat. I flew 9 hours that day, and it was mainly dive bomber strafing. We'd go up 18,000-20,000 feet and then pull out about 2,000 feet when you drop your bombs.
Well, you know, that's one of the questions. If you, I imagine it's hard to say, you know, how typical things went, because I imagine in those circumstances it was demanding to say the least. But you mentioned you had 75 hours of combat time. Now, how many sorties or missions would that?
Well, some of them were only a half hour, some were an hour, so were 2.5 hours. You know, the further we got into Germany, well, then you run. I think the longest mission is about 2.5 hours. That's the time to take off to came back and straight
all right. But in other words, we don't have your flight log or
no,
or
I don't have it.
Yeah,
just
handy
what
that
the 4 and 5. That's what it says.
that as far as tabulate. Now, I guess if somebody was trying to access an archive.
Sure.
To see what records exist on you, your serial numbers,
or what?
Your military serial number.
Oh.
If that might help to.
Oh, okay.
Obtain
well,
records on
like
you.
Said, a cadet serial number was 16-18-60-30. I can remember it that way. Now, when I graduated as a flight officer, it was an AO number, 939-477. And then I carried that, even though I got commissioned later on in civilian life, it still remained 939-477, but without the AO in the front of it, you know. And then, let's see, retired in 69, what, 66, 65, they started using your Social Security numbers. And that's when I picked up the Social Security number.
You said you retired in 69 from the Air Force.
From the Air Force, yeah. December of 69. Yeah.
All right. Now, getting back to your combat time, could you describe the typical day, if so to speak, understanding there were many variations?
Yeah. Well, we generally got up, I suppose, around 5:30. And it happened that in Lunéville, we were living in an old cavalry barn that was French used in World War I. Two-story barn, supposedly no heat in it, but you know, guys get innovative. We'd get a 5-gallon gas can, put a tube in it, had an old potbelly stove, put dirt in it, and we had heat in the unit from that 5-gallon gas can. But you had to be sure and put that standpipe in there, if not, you'd blow the whole damn barracks up. But anyway, from there, then we go to a briefing, and they brief you on the type of mission you were going to have, whether it was going to be just strafing, or if it was going to be dive bombing and strafing, give you your target. We always had a primary and a secondary target.
And so the briefings would usually be at roughly
An hour.
And starting at 6 or 7 in the morning?
Probably 7, yeah, something like that.
7 in the morning, they'd run about an hour.
Yeah, be up airborne around 8 o'clock. Now, our group took off and 12 ships went off. 4 ships per squadron. Our squadron had 4 ships, 14th had 4 ships and others, so there's 12 aircraft that went off.
In other words, for that particular mission, even though your squadron had more aircraft assigned.
Oh yeah, we had more aircraft assigned.
Roughly
that
how
mission.
Many?
Huh?
How many aircraft were assigned to the squadron when you say 4 went up for the actual
We only had 12 airborne. I suppose there's probably about 36 aircraft in a group.
12 per squadron.
I think around 12 a squadron, yeah. I would say, yeah. Because see, we had a total of about, 24, 28 pilots in our group, you know. And more than that. Our particular squadron, I think we had, 16, 18 pilots. The thing of it is, of the 18 pilots, I think 16 of us had motorcycles. We had more injuries in combat than motorcycle we did in combat flying, really.
Actually, that was going to be one of my questions about the, let's say, non-operational losses or other losses, non-combat.
Well, yeah, but look, you know, when you're 21, you know, you're gung-ho. And we had a mission, you know, we were fighting for our country at that time. And everybody was, you know, gung-ho. And like, say, I bought a British one-lunger motorcycle, a BMW. I happened to take over a quart of Canadian Club with me, and I bought it. I give the quart of Canadian Club to the sergeant, and that's how I bought my motorcycle.
Well, but, so then as far as that combat day, so to speak, say you had your briefing run an hour or so from 7. You find out your mission, strafe, dive bombing, primary, secondary targets, and then get airborne around 8.
Around 8, yeah. Say 2.5 hours, so you're back maybe by lunchtime, you know, on that. So what we did, if you flew 2 missions in 1 day, and one mission the next day, then you got the next day off. Now, the day that I flew, the 9 hours, about everybody got the next day off on that particular time. That's how they worked.
Well, did you find most days were 2 missions or 1?
Towards the end there, we were flying 2 missions a day, pretty much. And like I say, then the second mission was after lunch, and he'd get home just before dark. In fact, we got home one evening, just about dusk, and a German bomber, their 210 bomber, followed us home. And we had no more than gotten out of the aircraft, had debriefed, and he strafed the air. Well, he came over and dropped bombs. But the guy, he didn't hit our airport at all. He damaged a French house right across the road from us, put holes in a Frenchman's house, killed a little 16-year-old girl. The only casualty we had was a crew chief was on a refueling a P-47. He jumped off the wing and he broke his ankle when he went into the revetment ditch. That's the only casualty we had. But now the type of bombs they dropped were what we call butterfly bombs or anti-personnel bombs. When they hit, they don't necessarily go off. But when the bomb group, when you move them, then is when they go off, and they're anti-personnel, which we use the same type. We call them butterfly bombs that we dropped from our aircraft.
And so this incident where this 210
just
attack,
that one incident towards the end of it.
That was mid-March, late March.
That was right in April.
April.
It was just a last-ditch effort, I guess, and but it didn't damage. See, we had our airfield surrounded with 40 millimeters and all that kind of stuff, and just caught everybody by surprise. And I think they got a few shots at him, but we never did get him. But he missed the whole airfield.
And when you would come back, you would go through
debriefing. Go through debriefing.
And
yeah.
How long did that on average take?
Depends on whether you were the 4 pilots debriefing at the same time on the mission, or if they debriefed you one at a time, might take an hour, you know, half hour, an hour, depending on what you had done that day.
And after the debrief, you were
free then on your own, or if you had another mission, then you generally had lunchtime to debrief and go back on another flight. When I was flying at that time, Like I said, we took off in 12-ship formation. We flew out in 12-ship in an echelon until we got to altitude. Then we split up to fly with your own squadron of 4 ships. Our biggest threat then, at that time, was the ME-262.
The jet?
The German jet. They would fly through our formation when we were around 12, 14,000 feet. They'd lob a few shells at us, and they knew that we either were at 18 or 20,000 feet. They'd sit up at 25,000 feet and harass us. They'd also set another guy down about 10,000 feet. That was a sucker bait. You didn't go after him. You just left him alone. Now, when they ran out of fuel, then they went back to their home base. It turns out, 1984, I ran into a German pilot. Well, I was flying a Learjet at the time for State Farm. We were doing our maintenance at Indianapolis, Combs Gates. There was a German 35 there at the time. He had a fuel leak. And I got introduced to him. His name was Carl Brill. Never forget him. And he had flown FW-190s and ME-262s. So we were talking about it, and he's the one that said, yes, they had 50 minutes of fuel. And they changed the engine every 9 hours. The reason being is they didn't, the metallurgy at that time for your heat in your jet engine was as infancy. And he said, we had all our, their lines shut up from Spain. They couldn't get the silver for the bearings. So that's why, and I said, well, we dive bomb, we strafed around the Munich area and that. And he said, well, that's where I was flying out of Munich area. See, they used the Autobahn as a runway. So they have a 5-mile runway. And when they run out of fuel, they go by land at the Autobahn and they tow them back to their revetments. And that's how they operated.
Now, you said you bomb and strafed in, yeah, in the Munich area.
Okay.
Would you say, what other, well, what? Let me take that back.
Okay.
And, you mentioned the big threats and
yeah,
the Messerschmitt 262.
Yeah.
And of course, at this point, the Luftwaffe had encountered a lot of losses.
They practically weren't non-existent time. We got jumped. The only time I got, might say, is FW-190. We goofed. We normally, when we did a dive bomb run, we would send 4 aircraft down at a time, and the other 8 would stay up in like a luff barrier or like a racetrack protecting each other's hind end, more or less to speak. And we decided that, well, the Germans, there weren't any more Germans around, so we'd send 8 down in a dive bomb run at one time and leave 4 up. Well, when about 7 or 8 were already starting a dive bomb run, we got jumped by 9 FW-190s. So it was a matter of everybody drop bombs, drop your bombs, your belly tanks, and form back into a left barrier into a circle. Now, an FW-190, if we could get him above 15,000 feet, we could outturn him. But below 15,000 feet, he's going to beat you, and the only thing a jug could do is outrun him. You could outdive him, outrun him. But we stayed in a left barrier, and then they started making a pass at it. It turned out that I heard maybe 2 or 3 times the guy coming at you, you do what they call a vertical reverse type thing, like a half snap roll, and then back in your circle to climb for altitude. We got 3 of theirs, and we lost 3 of ours. And I guess they were running out of fuel, we were running out of fuel, and it broke it off and went back home. But we did lose. I think out of the 3 pilots, only 1 bailed out, and the other 2 were lost. And just one of those days.
The guy who bailed out, did he get captured?
He probably ended up with a prisoner of war. But he was probably on a prisoner of war for a month. And he back home again, you know.
Okay.
You know, since it's right at the end of the world.
Not sure if he...
No, I'm not really sure, no.
What happened?
Right.
Now, as far as threats, of course, what? I imagine FLAC...
Well, 88, Germans were very accurate with 88. We call it cotton candy. I don't know. What they did when you had an overcast, we would be below an overcast. When they sent up an 88, they'd have it colored. Green, red, yellow. What they were doing, they were finding out what your altitude was. Of course, when you'd see cotton candy at 10 o'clock low, we changed our altitude and headings. Whereas the bomber guys, they couldn't do that. We had one incident, one of our guys, He was close enough to an 88. It blew his canopy off at 18,000 feet. By the time we got home and trying to get him to drop his bombs, he liked to froze to death. You know, he kept saying, "You guys, let's get down, let's get down." And he tried to dive bomb with his bombs on. When he started down, he had to break it off because it was sucking him out of the cockpit. So we had radar over there. Our radar name was Baby. And we went to a target. Our primary and secondary target was overcast, and we couldn't do a dive bomb run. We could not land back home with bombs. We had to get rid of the bombs. So what they did, you flew in a real tight formation, about like the Thunderbirds, as close as you could get, and then radar would run you over a target, over a town or a munition yard or whatever it was, and tell you when to drop your bombs. We call it an egg basket. So he says, "Where'd you hit?" And I said, "Oh, probably a German outhouse. I don't know. You know, I have no idea, you know." It was just a blind deal. But
you called that radar?
Well, Baby was our, that was the code name. That was our main radar station.
It was the station, but the type of radar?
Don't ask me.
Oh,
at the time they said radar, at that time most of us didn't even know we had radar. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they vectored you around. For instance, well, on another mission we escorted B-26s, the only one I escorted B-26s. We were over Munich, we were at 25,000, the bombers were at 20. One of the bombers got hit by 88. I had an oil line come off. I was losing oil and oil pressure. And, of course, 25,000 feet over Munich, you can see Lake Constantine. Well, that's what